Welcome to the Sleep Junkies podcast. My name's Jeff Mann, and I'm the founder and editor of sleepjunkies.com. And we cover the whole conversation on sleep. So we talk about the science and the health aspects. We talk about the culture of sleep, the sleep industry. Pretty much, if it's an interesting topic and it's got anything to do with sleep, we're up for talking about it. And today we're going to talk about different tactics and strategies to help children who have sleep problems. And today we're talking to a clinical child psychologist who's helped hundreds and hundreds of children and their parents to get over their sleep challenges and find strategies and tactics to help them improve their sleep. So hopefully if you're a parent who does have a child who's experiencing some issues, you'll get some real useful information from this podcast. So that's it for the introduction. If you're liking the Sleep Junkies podcast, don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review on iTunes. You can also check us on social media, on Instagram, on Twitter, on our Facebook group, Sleep Junkies Worldwide, and of course, on the website, sleepjunkies.com. So, on with the show. Enjoy. So I'm joined on the other end of the line, all the way from Australia, with Professor Michael Gradisar. And well, it's good morning for you, but I'll say good morning, but it's evening here.
So I'll say good evening. You're welcome, and thanks for making this time.
I just wondered if you could give people a bit of a background, how you got into sleep and where you've built up this practice. And I believe you started out as a single clinical psychologist, and now you've got a full team of researchers. Can you just give us a brief synopsis of how that journey started and how it got to where you are now?
Yeah, I guess it started at Flinders University and it ends at Flinders University. That's where actually I'm talking from. But you can't do a degree at Flinders University in psychology without having some lectures or even some topics on sleep. So I think back when I was a third year undergraduate, I had a topic about sleep that was taken by Leon Lack, and that was my first experience of this area, and I was completely fascinated by it. It sort of just really stuck with me, and I found the content very interesting. I found that it was something that really did apply to a lot of people out there in the world. And so from there, I managed to eventually get a job with Leon, and that was in 1998, working on a big project in the sleep laboratory that he ran here. And I think by a mixture of hard work and a bit of luck, I just kept going, did my master's degree, which allowed me to become a clinical psychologist, and then went to do a PhD. Again, I did that under Leon. And then towards the end of that, there was a job going where they were looking for someone who had some sort of experience in clinical child psychology, and they were struggling at that point, and that was around 2005, and I'd done some research with kids, and so I went for it, and like I said, I started out as a single person. I was told, now you're a lecturer in clinical child psychology, you got to do research in kids, not with adults. So I had a look at sleeping kids, and there wasn't much out there, so I started to have a crack at it, and just kept going.
It's quite interesting. You say you were actually taught about sleep. My perception is it's something that's not widely taught. So is that something special about Flinders?
Certainly. I guess, you know, if you look at it almost like a tree, you know, like it sort of started to branch out a little bit back there in the 1990s with a few people here and there. And I think we were just fortunate that Leon Lack, who did his studies over at Stanford, and had connections with people over there, specifically Bill Dement, he's actually still working in the area and has been working in the sleep research field for a long time. So we were fortunate enough to just study under someone who was basically influenced by one of the greats. And from there, he taught a number of people and they're teaching other people. And I'd still say that the perception that I get, because I guess I do a few workshops around Australia and sometimes overseas, I will ask the attendees how much sleep content that they got during their undergraduate degrees and also postgraduate training. And more often than not, they hadn't. And they're sort of like learning on the job. But I think, like you said, we're seeing a change. I think we'll see more of it. People are able to do this themselves more than they have been in the past. We've got stuff like Google Scholar. I certainly encourage families and health professionals to use Google Scholar because it's a free resource where you can actually learn about sleep directly rather than hearing it secondhand through people. So it's great to see that there's more education getting out there to the community.
I wanted to talk about your book today. It's co-written by yourself and a colleague of yours, Rachel Hiller. You describe it as a self-help book, and it's based around, you know, helping your child with sleep problems. And it's for school-age children, isn't it, rather than the baby sleep age group, which you do deal with as well. But this book is very much about school-age children.
Yeah, definitely. Like you mentioned, you know, I started out with adult sleep, and then I noticed that in an adult clinic sometimes we were getting teenagers coming in. I was like, what's this about? You're supposed to be sleeping well. And then when I got my job in child psychology, I started to work with school-aged children and also toddlers and infants. And so we could have, I mean, this is our first book, and we could have written a book for teenagers or for infants, but it was really this population that was really curious to us and still is curious to me, because if you look at the number of, say, self-help books that you could probably find online or in a shop, and they are about sleep, they're more oriented towards adult sleep and potentially adult insomnia or infant sleep. But if you look at the population of school-age kids, so this is around what we call primary school-age kids, and they have really been a forgotten lot, almost as an assumption that they sleep fine. But we noticed when we opened up our clinic here at Flinders University, just up to 7 to 18-year-olds, we did get a number of parents approaching us saying, you know, my child's not sleeping well. They can't sleep by themselves. They're really anxious at night. So we started to almost like develop techniques and a sort of combination of techniques to try to help them, and then we started to evaluate them, and now we've sort of got to a point where we're starting to analyze what sort of works within those techniques. So I think it's a really neglected population that we're trying to get out there and try to help these families.
But this is about, you know, these are evidence-based sleep treatments that you've developed through clinical practice and through research, and so these are things that are tried and tested, you know, that have worked.
Yeah, for sure. And that's where my training in an adult insomnia clinic really came to the fore. I was like, okay, so if we think about the cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia techniques that we use for adults, which one of those might sort of apply to these kids? And when we looked at these cognitive behavior therapy techniques for anxiety for kids, we were like, okay, so we can imagine these techniques might work. So we essentially lumped those together as a package. And like you say, we tested it. Now we're on to a point where we're actually looking at how brief can we make these techniques so it's more cost effective for families, because they're so time poor and it's hard to sort of come to a clinic. So
I just want to make a distinction here, because, you know, you've got anxiety related problems and also you deal with parasomnias as well, but there are some more serious issues that school children might have, things like maybe sleep disordered breathing problems like that. But your book is to deal with, is it fair to say, more anxiety-related problems and the things that are treatable with, let's say, cognitive and behavioural type therapies?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, when we opened up our clinic and we said, you know, we were a bit like the Statue of Liberty, you know, just bring everyone, let's see what happens. And the most common presentation that we saw were these children that really had difficulty trying to fall asleep by themselves. They really needed to have some sort of parental presence. So there was certainly a huge overlap between insomnia and the anxiety, and this is part of, you know, the journey and the interest that we have, is that technically we haven't done a proper diagnostic assessment of whether these children that we've been seeing would be diagnosed with an anxiety disorder, but certainly experts within that area who have looked at the diagnostic criteria for insomnia say that they see a lot of insomnia occurring for the children that present with anxiety disorders. And for us, and probably for your listeners, the sort of situations that we saw were that you'd have a child that would go to bed in their own bedroom, but they needed a parent to be in the room, or, you know, in some situations on top of the covers or underneath the covers, or that child needed the parent to be in the adjacent room, like in the kitchen, so that they could hear that they were still awake. And then we had children that had really got to a situation where they were on a mattress on the floor next to the parents' bed, and that's pretty much a permanent situation that the parents wanted to change. And then even other situations where there was a parent who basically shared their bed with their child and dad was kicked out into a different room, and that was a commonplace thing. We even had it the most extreme. One family, it was a single mum and the child was 13 years of age, and the child had basically always slept in the mum's bed. And so getting to the age of 13 years, it was time to sort of see if he could try to go to his own bedroom, but he never learned that. He never had those skills. And so you can imagine, times 365 nights by 13 years, that's a lot of practice to sleep with someone present. So very difficult to unlearn that and relearn new skills. But still, we found these techniques were successful.
I wanted to dissect the book a little bit. So you've got three chapters here, or three sections of the book. The first part of the book deals with this idea of what does healthy sleep, that's my term, you know, what does sleep look like? What should sleep look like for a child who's just started school at school age? Where can you identify where there are problems, and, you know, what are the main problems in there? And I know this is a huge subject for you, and you've spent decades, you know, in this field, but I just wondered if you could sum up for our listeners some of the signs, you know, where things are looking okay and things maybe there is an actual issue here.
Oh, I have to take my hat off to the editors here, who not only helped us do many rewrites but also helped to structure the book, but also at this point of the book to sort of say, let's see if we can make a bit more of a clear distinction between what good sleep looks like and what problematic sleep looks like. And I think that's really important. That's what we try to do in the clinic, is to sort of say, almost like validate for the parents that are coming in, yes, this is a problem, because that's in some ways the first step. You can have one parent that thinks this is a problem, and then the other parent says, no, this is fine, just needs a bit of tough love or some sort of advice like that. So, in the book we do outline what good sleep should be like. We also give symptoms of what might occur if sleep is not going so well. So they can be things that you see at the start of the night when you've got that bedtime process of trying to settle them down, or if something happens during the night, or indeed if you find that they're really struggling to get out of bed in the mornings. And like I mentioned before, it's those sort of issues particularly that the parents would be aware of, is that they sort of can't wind down for the night. They've still got a final job, which is the child has to get to sleep, and they have to help them get to sleep. So I think many parents that are putting in that extra effort at night when they're really tired and fatigued and want to just have their own time, they're quite well aware that, you know, this is a problem. And in the book, we want to sort of say, yes, this is an issue for you. And usually what parents might sort of do, which is totally understandable, is that they're so sleep deprived and they'll try to use a short-term solution, which is to say, okay, just hop into bed tonight, or look, we'll just bring your mattress into our bedroom. And unfortunately, that problem still sticks around. So it's really important for us to sort of not only distinguish good sleep from poor sleep, but why poor sleep might occur. Talking about the fact that all kids are born differently, most families that have at least two kids will see that a couple of them are chalk and cheese. So trying to sort of say, you know, this is how they start out. But also there can be certain triggers sometimes. Some are quite obvious and some are not, that might sort of trigger poor sleep. And some of the things we do as parents that we inadvertently reinforce bad sleep. And it's important to sort of see that. And it's not to shame or guilt parents, because, you know, there's no manual that comes out with these babies about what to do. We try to do what's best, and sometimes it just doesn't work. It's really something that we didn't know about. And so from there, I think it's really important for parents to know why poor sleep happens and what contributes to it, so they've got this broad theory. So when we're in the clinic, we really try to teach a lot of families about the basic theories of sleep. So if they understand the theories, they can understand the technique that you can use that is aligned to one of those theories.
So maybe you could just run through the sleep hygiene basics tailored towards the demographic for this book, the primary school age children.
Yeah, and certainly by the time a lot of families see us, they've tried some of these sleep hygiene techniques and it hasn't necessarily worked for them. People can look at it in terms of what you ingest that might affect sleep. So caffeine is one of the biggest ones, and probably people don't realize what products contain caffeine. They don't realize that the darker chocolate that you have, the more caffeine is in that dark chocolate. Sometimes people don't realize how much caffeine is in black tea. Sometimes people don't realize that caffeine is in green tea. So that's something that people could be made aware of in terms of how much chocolate or tea that their child might be having.
Soft drinks, I guess, for kids as well, isn't it?
Yep, certainly the colas can have caffeine in them. And certainly when you think about the approach to bedtime, you really have to sort of think about it like a volume knob. Like you're really trying to dial down stimulation. So whether that stimulation internally about what you ingest, but also physical activity, lighting, noise, all of those things, everything should start to really destimulate and be quieter. So you don't want to have too much stimulation towards bedtime, whether it's the child's environment or whether it's going to also be something that they ingest.
What are some other sleep hygiene tips? I'm thinking of things like routine, for instance. Lighting, you mentioned.
Yep. So if we go through some of them, so for instance, one is to suggest avoid napping, because if you nap, you'll then basically get a bit of sleep, and that means it's going to be harder to sleep at night. We actually find a lot of school-age kids don't really nap. So usually that's not sort of an issue for this actual demographic. Regular bedtimes is also something that is suggested. You do see a bit of that. Like, so what we mention in the book and what we do with parents when they come to see us in a clinic is to complete a sleep diary over 1 week, where the parents with the child will indicate what times they go to bed and what times they get up out of bed, both on school weeks and weekends. So we do look at the variability of that. That's actually quite an important thing. And some of the new sort of sleep hygiene that's coming through is really about technology use. So trying to have remove any sort of technological devices from the bedroom and trying not to have stimulating technological activities before bed. Although that's coming through, we've also done a lot of research with teenagers. I think we might have mentioned this a little bit in the book, and we've been trying to test some of these theories of arousal using technology use and the bright light from screens. We're actually finding it's not as strong as what people are suggesting, but that's probably another talk for another time. But we do sort of sometimes mention to some specific families that they can probably swap out some of the more interactive technological activities, especially on mobile phones, and something as simple as watching TV could be less harmful if they struggle to sort of remove all technological devices from their child.
We see quite a lot of sometimes quite hard line coverage about this stuff to do with screens and blue light. But you're not quite as hard line as that. You're saying, you know, well, we need to see more evidence about this.
Absolutely. I mean, we've conducted our own study in the sleep lab here at Flinders with teenagers. We gave them an iPad on full brightness, and another time we gave it on complete low dim. And this is in the hour before bed. It's on a very bright white screen. And we also had a filter so that it actually gave a warmth, orangey sort of colour to the screen. And, you know, in this sort of situation, we have a very controlled environment, so we can really look at cause and effect and see the effect of that screen on the sleep of these teenagers. And we measured their sleep with the best measures, which is to use EEG. And we could not find any differences really between having a bright screen in the hour before bed versus having a dim screen. So we were like a bit puzzled by that. But then when we saw other studies that were coming out from around the world, they were really confirming something similar to us. There's been a real failure to say that there is a direct link between bright screens and the effect directly on sleep. So I might sort of provide a bit of a caution here. What there seems to be consistent evidence of is that if you use a bright screen for at least 1.5 hours continuously before bedtime, then that will mean that people are more alert. And if you're more alert at home, you're more likely to then continue using that device and delay your bedtime. So there's a sort of indirect path how bright screens could potentially affect sleep, but it's more so through the alertness that it provides and people just not being able to stop themselves.
There are definite guidelines in the book to avoid stimulating activities like that, but you're basically saying that we still need more evidence to be clearer about the effects of these things.
Exactly. And what we attribute the poor sleep to, it might not necessarily be the blue light. In fact, if I just sort of dabbled into it a little bit, our research and research of other groups is now starting to look at really individual differences, I guess is what we would call it. There are some people that are more likely to continue using a particular device or a particular, say, video game more than others, depending upon certain personality characteristics, but they also interact with the activity that they're doing. So there are, on the other side of the fence, there are game developers that are purposely putting AI algorithms, which mean that people are more likely to continue playing. And if you look at something, I guess if you compare, say, Facebook to Instagram, I mean, at least my Instagram at this point will say you're up to date. You know, there's a sort of definitive end, whereas Facebook can jumble up all of the stories chronologically all the time. So there's never seeming to be an end. So there seems to us to be more of an interaction between the particular activity on a technological device and that person's personality characteristics. That actually seems to be the way that the field should be looking at where the research is telling us the damaging effects of technology is occurring for sleep.
You're absolutely right. I mean, Facebook, all of these companies, they want to hook people in. That's a really interesting point you raised about, rather than the technology itself, how these different platforms are designed to, you know, to keep people hooked. And if it's at nighttime, obviously that's going to affect their sleep.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that's where people hopefully get to be more educated. I mean, even people in the scientific world are missing sort of some of these studies on personality characteristics at this point. So if we're, you know, struggling to convince them, it's going to be hard to sort of get that message out to people in the community.
Okay. What about, it's quite a contentious issue. And again, it's a very personal thing to do with the child and the parents and the, you know, the culture of the families. But what about bedtime? You know, what do you advise? But I know, speaking to some people and some parents, and I'm thinking, really, that's like really, really early. And then they get up at 5:30 or 6 in the morning, which might be suitable for the family. But, you know, is it suitable for the kids? You know, what are your guidelines, you know, generally with regards to bedtimes?
Yeah, it goes back to that whole point that these babies don't pop out with a manual. So it's hard to know what their bedtime is going to be at different ages. And so when parents do come to us, we do really work a lot with them on trying to find the best bedtime for that child. So that might be the second child that has presented that has a sleep problem. So their first child slept quite fine. So they do have some experience in this matter, but when they try to apply those techniques to this second child, it doesn't seem to work. And like you mentioned, you know, you sort of go to the school and you start to talk to other parents, and you know, there might start to be a conversation around about bedtimes. And like you said, you know, we had the same sort of thing. Like one parent said that their child was put to bed at 7 o'clock every night. And we thought, oh, wow, that's really early. But it really has to be tailored to the individual child because they are born quite differently. And, you know, as parents, we sort of take whatever experiences and information that we've got from talking to other parents or maybe family members or what happened with our previous children. And so in the book, we really sort of try to give step-by-step techniques about how you can really try to find, or in some ways experiment with, the bedtime for your particular child. And it has to be done in, you know, certain ways so that you can eventually find out a bedtime that means that they're going to be able to fall asleep a lot quicker, and they'll be able to hopefully sleep more consistently through the night. So it's a really important issue, and fortunately, it's a fairly simple technique to do in some sort of ways compared to some of the more cognitive techniques that you can do with your child.
There's been a lot of stuff in the last couple of years about chronotype and this idea that, you know, we're all individuals and we all have a sleep timing, and you know, there's been books out about, you know, are you a dolphin or a bear or whatever, as opposed to just, you know, the binary lark or owl thing. But we always apply that to adults. But there's going to be chronotypes within kids, even though their sleep is completely different to adults. But then if you've got 2, 3, 4 kids, you can't tailor all of their sleep individually to their chronotypes. But I guess, as you say, it's got to be tailored in some way to, you know, the child's needs.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we're sort of talking about a couple of important issues. One is chronotype, and chronotype it has a genetic influence there. And so what we are talking about is how late the body wants to tell that individual or that child to fall asleep and when to wake up. So you can have a child that basically has a chronotype that means they're more likely to fall asleep later, and another child that can mean that their body is dictating that they fall asleep earlier. And aside from that, though, you can also have this genetic influence on the amount of sleep that a child needs. So this is where some parents get quite frustrated when they find out from us that, look, you know, you just happen to have a child that needs less than the amount of average sleep than a child of their age. So that's also something to be aware of. So those two can sometimes confuse the matter a bit. Sometimes what we try to do is really look at chronotype first to make sure that that's in the sort of correct place, so it's not too late and it's not too early. And then from there, we then would have an idea about whether this is a child that just needs far less sleep than the usual child. Like, you don't see so many consequences that occur because this child is getting 7 hours sleep. They seem to get by on that. And that was really an experience I've seen across the age range. At worst, I've seen a couple of clients. They were only getting 2 hours of sleep per night, but they were functioning on 2 hours of sleep.
Wow.
That's a real extreme of how variable the amount of sleep, even including school-age kids, it can vary quite a lot. And we don't necessarily, you know, measure it. Like, our first session is really asking a lot of questions, doing a big Q&A to really understand what are the what we call contributing factors to the child's sleep problem. You know, what are the things that are affecting this kid's sleep? And then in the second session, we really educate parents about what we think is happening to their sleep. Sometimes there's a bit of a discussion about they sort of feel responsible and guilty, and we have to really jump on that straight away and say, look, this is so common from what we see, and we often will do it as parents. We do it inadvertently. You know, we can influence their behaviours, but you have to understand the child is also built differently, and it just means that you've just got to use different techniques for that particular child.
And then it's a big sigh of relief, you see.
Exactly. Yeah, they leave much more calmer, which is really great to see, and that potentially has also some sort of effect down the line about how they interact with their child at night.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of these practical step-by-step techniques.
Yep. We were looking at techniques from two different sort of areas. One was adult insomnia and one was for anxiety for kids. So just looking at the adult insomnia techniques, there's one technique which is called a behavioral technique, and it's got a bit of a scary name. It's called sleep restriction therapy. So immediately when we say this to parents, we've got to sort of explain it and try to put them at ease. But this is a technique that's been around since 1987 for adults with insomnia. And it's really based upon the physiological process that a lot of people don't really know about, but unfortunately they experience it all the time, which is called sleep pressure. So the idea is when you wake up in the morning, you start to build up sleep pressure. And therefore, the longer that you're awake, the more sleepy you get. And the more sleepy you get, the quicker you will fall asleep. So when you look at the actual technique for sleep restriction therapy in adults with insomnia, it's really completing a sleep diary first. So this can be quite a valuable learning experience for the parent, and you can download a lot of these sleep diaries from the internet. If you just go into Google Images and do a search for sleep diary or sleep log, even if you search Child and Adolescent Sleep Clinic Flinders University, we've got one you can download from our homepage. And we have one also available in the book. And what you then do is you look at the average amount of sleep that your child is getting over a week. And then the idea is that you say, okay, well, if my child is getting 8 hours of sleep, then I'm going to provide them with 8 hours of opportunity in bed. So in other words, they might go to bed at, believe it or not, 10 o'clock at night, and then get 8 hours of sleep opportunity, meaning they wake up at 6 a.m. And the idea is you do that for a few nights or for a week, and then you see what their sleep is like. Is it, has it improved? And if that's the case, fantastic. But you also got to look out for any consequences. Are they starting to look a bit sleepy when they're sort of there at the daytime when they come home from school? Are they struggling to get out of bed? Does the teacher sort of report that their behavior or inattention is occurring? And if so, that's when you start to play around with their bedtimes. So you'll sort of get them to go to bed maybe at 9:30 for another week and try to extend that sleep opportunity. And therefore, that sort of goes back to what I was saying before. You start to experiment with moving around the bedtimes until you can find the ideal bedtimes for that child at that particular point of their development. So when we look at that technique, technically it's not restricting sleep. So we label that technique bedtime restriction therapy. So we're actually playing around with bedtimes for that child. So that's one of the techniques that we've started to really evaluate and test at Flinders University with a number of different families. But we've also gone a bit further and thought, well, what if we actually do restrict the sleep of these kids? And so we've actually done a technique that is called sleep restriction therapy, whereby if a child has an average of 8 hours of sleep over a given week, we'll actually provide them with 7.5 hours of time in bed. So we actually are restricting their sleep a bit, which everyone says you shouldn't do. So we actually went ahead and did it. And the idea was that I had this sort of experience when I haven't got as much sleep on a given time, the next day I don't really give a toss. You know, I'm not worried about things so much. And I wondered about these kids that are sort of lying there at night and worried about, what's going to happen to school the next day. Sometimes they're worried about some sort of intruder breaking into their house. And we did actually look through the scientific literature and find that there was some suggestions that if you are able to build up sleepiness, it's really the counter opposite to arousal that occurs with anxiety. So we've started to test that over a number of years and found that the parents that do go ahead with it, they actually report very quick benefits. In some cases, we had a parent come back the following week and said, it's all fixed. So bedtime restriction therapy and sleep restriction therapy, they're sort of very similar, and we outline in the book maybe which one you want to try first, depending upon your child's sleep problems. So we've got a roadmap, we call it, in the book. But those are two of the techniques that are fairly powerful and can provide some quick results that we have step-by-step instructions for in the book.
Just to anyone who's not aware, a lot of people are calling it the gold standard now for treating insomnia, which is CBTI, cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. I could imagine some parents hearing that, 10 o'clock, recoiling in horror, but these are actually techniques that we know they work in adults.
Exactly. And we were highly aware, though, being parents ourselves, that we had to also measure while we were testing sleep restriction therapy any sort of consequences that would occur for these kids. So we did some measures of their sort of say abilities within intelligence, cognitive performance, we call them, also teacher reports, also trying to find out about how sleepy they might feel. And this is a technique, keep in mind, that we sort of do over a two-week period, and we didn't see any significant consequences from doing sleep restriction therapy overall for these kids compared to a control group where we didn't restrict their sleep or didn't play around too much with their bedtimes. So it's very important that we try to do some evidence, and the evidence at this point is showing us that we're not we're getting some technique that sounds scary, and I know you can imagine that occurring with parents. I saw it face-to-face the first time I mentioned to their child that they had to go to bed at 11 o'clock at night. I think the reaction was, what?
Yeah, I can imagine.
And I was thinking, I partly agree with you, but the good news is at least that we are struggling to find any harm, and it's a short-term solution for a problem that for a lot of the families that come and see us, that's been going on for sometimes an average of 5 years.
Wow. Yeah. Can I just ask you this distinction between the sleep restriction and bedtime restriction?
For kids, obviously, if we're sort of saying, stay up until 10 o'clock, 10:30, that sort of first week, parents are like, oh, my God, how am I going to stay up that late? So we do recommend that it's really a case of them attempting sleep at that time. So if we're sort of saying 10 o'clock is their new bedtime, in finger quotes, it's really sort of saying at 10 o'clock, lie down, dim the light or shut the light off if the child can do that. But they still can be in their bed, and we recommend quiet activities like reading a book, listening to music, and so we really will go through with families about what sort of activities that they can do. So they could actually be in their bedroom for an hour leading up to that new bedtime, just doing quiet activities, and it can be just in dim light conditions, it can be just playing with something on the floor, moving to doing something on top of the bed covers, doing something underneath the bed covers, and then when it's time to fall asleep at 10 o'clock, then they can turn the light off and attempt sleep then. So there can be some modifications around it to make it easy for parents to do it.
Right. So it's not as strict as the guidelines you give to adults. Get out of your bed, go somewhere else, somewhere dimly lit and read a book or whatever. They are allowed to be in the bedroom, you know.
Yeah, well, and on that point, you know, this sort of harks back to that issue that we were fortunate enough to sort of be studying under Leon Lack, because Leon Lack was quite good friends with Richard Bootson, who developed stimulus control therapy, which is that technique that you speak of, that, you know, if you can't fall asleep within 15 to 20 minutes in bed, get up, go to another room, do something quiet under dim light. When you feel sleepy, go back to bedroom and try again. And, you know, we were able to have Dick Bootson come here to Flinders and spend some time with him. And I've had a conversation, you know, with him many years ago. And he did actually say you don't have to go into another bedroom, another room. You can actually just get up out of bed and sit in a chair next to the bed, as long as it's a different sort of stimulus. It's not necessarily the bedroom that has to be something that you need to avoid. So there can be, by the sounds of it, these different modifications to this particular technique.
Fantastic. This is not related to the book, but it's related to the subject. There's been some coverage recently about attention deficit disorders in kids and misdiagnosis, discussions about Big Pharma and all that. But there's been some discussion and some studies to say that potentially some of these kids who are showing symptoms of hyperactivity and ADD symptoms in the daytime might just be sleep deprived. I mean, and it's not directly related to what you talk about in the book, but I'm guessing you must have come across some of this in your work.
Yeah, and it's more so with the younger children, like toddlers, that are in that sort of developmental phase where they can get up and move around and so forth, and certainly related to sleep disordered breathing. The idea if they're having that sort of poor quality sleep and fragmented sleep. So in other words, when they're trying to sleep and they're trying to breathe, they're not getting enough oxygen because their airways are becoming restricted. The brain essentially wakes them up and they're not getting into that sort of nice, continuous, good sleep. It's fascinating that in that particular age group compared to adults, they don't necessarily feel sleepy or show those signs of sleepiness. They, if anything, show signs of hyperactivity. And hence it has that sort of presentation of ADHD and could actually be misdiagnosed where you in fact find that with a number of children, if the situation is that they have this sleep disorder breathing because they have these large adenoids and tonsils and actually have those removed, a lot of families have said they've seen a complete change in their child and this hyperactivity is gone. So that's certainly an issue, and you know, that's aside from the issue, the controversial issue about whether a child truly has ADHD or not. Because if they do have ADHD, and we have seen those school age attending children, then yes, it's very difficult for the parents. They do have a child that is up very late at night. And they also have a child that can sometimes wake up quite early in the morning. You know, it could be a case that they fall asleep at 10:30 at night. They're very disruptive to the other kids in the family, and then they're awake at 5 o'clock and they're ready to go again. So in those particular instances, it's very hard for families. I think usually what happens from our clinical experience is that they are prescribed some sort of stimulant, which helps to ease those symptoms for the child, especially if they're school attending. They might have some sort of pill that's happened that they give them in the morning before they go to school that will last over that sort of school period. Sometimes they'll give them maybe another pill when they come home, but then they find that they have these sleep problems. They'll go back to their GP or pediatrician and essentially have some sort of pill to try to bring them down again. And for parents, that could be a bit heartbreaking because, you know, they're sort of thinking, what am I doing to my child with all of these chemical medications by Big Pharma? And what we've done in these sort of situations when we've been referred these clients, and we don't mention this in the book, but what we do is really work with the pediatrician or with the GP to sort of really reduce to a point where they stop taking the nighttime medication and replace that with melatonin. And usually for kids, they will like liquid melatonin. And I know I'm now entering another controversial area.
Yeah, I was going to bring it up because it's another hot topic but it's perceived as a natural product and not a sleeping pill. And if it's working, it's sending kids to sleep, and they're thinking, well, I'm going to carry on doing this. But there's issues. Could you talk about that a bit more?
Yeah, I mean, the idea is that you still try to go for these cognitive and behavioral techniques when you do see a child that's experiencing sleep problems. And if they fail, then the second line of treatment is to look at melatonin. There'll be cases where I would reverse that and go for melatonin straight away. So I clearly remember a case I had over a year ago where it was a child that was around 3-4 years of age, and the parents were very sleep deprived. And if you looked at this child's sleep diary, yes, they were falling asleep much later than a child should, I guess, on average for a 3 to 4 year old, and was also awake quite early. So the parents were themselves feeling quite sleep restricted. And when the family mentioned that the husband, I forgot what sort of trade he did, but he works on roofs, and he fell off a roof, and he attributed that to sleep deprivation. And so in a situation like that, something like melatonin can provide some pretty quick results for kids. And so when a family is at risk like that, that's a case where I would sort of say, look, let's get onto this straight away. Unfortunately, I cannot prescribe it. I'm a psychologist by trade. So we have to try to sort of do this through a pediatrician or a GP, and then they have to go from there to see a pharmacist. And I think, like what we sort of discussed previously in this podcast, is that sometimes their education is not up to date with the research. And there are certainly articles out there that do say that melatonin is useful for kids and also for adolescents, so, under 18s. But we'll often get blocked. The family will get blocked, and they'll find a GP or the pediatrician says, no, I'm not going to do this. Or sometimes we've even had the GP say, yep, here you go, here's the script, and then the pharmacist has been really giving the Q&A about it and finding blocks there. But certainly in children that present with autism, some children that present with this true ADHD, and especially where there's a risk to the family, whatever that might be, then certainly I will go for something like liquid melatonin, especially if the child is under, say, 10 years of age.
I'm thinking I'm going to do a whole podcast on melatonin, because it's a huge subject, and I know we've veered off track a little bit. But are there any other sort of practical techniques in there we want to talk about?
Well, I guess there's a couple of other important techniques that we do, because we have described bedtime restriction therapy and sleep restriction therapy, but there can be cases where the family will do that, but the child is still sleeping in their parents' bedroom. So in such situations, it's important to teach the child certain skills so they can then sleep more independently. So we cover a technique called cognitive therapy. It's really looking at trying to get kids to sort of voice what sort of thoughts are worrying them at night or scaring them at night, and getting them to really try to test out those thoughts and evaluate them for how probable they will occur, but also looking for alternative reasons. So commonly we'll find that kids will say that they're very afraid that there's going to be some sort of intruder that breaks in and causes harm to themselves or their parents. And so we say, okay, well, that makes sense. If you're thinking something like that, you're going to feel quite anxious and you're going to have trouble falling asleep. But what sort of what will trigger a thought like this? And I'll say, oh, that they hear some sort of sound outside, and say, okay, so but what else could make that sound? And then they start to really generate a lot of different ideas. It could be an animal, it could be a cat, it could be the wind, a tree knocking. And that's when they start to realize that they can practice these skills, and it certainly needs practicing, so that they can have some sort of cognitive mastery over their emotions. So that's one of the techniques that we go through. And the next one is really getting them to be more brave about, I guess, and exposing themselves to this sort of scary situation about trying to fall asleep by not being so close to their parents. So that's usually a technique called exposure therapy. So they're basically learning a new skill, and that allows them to therefore not necessarily sleep in the bedroom with the parents, but eventually sleep in their own bed. So those are two other important techniques for families that have a child that has that strong dependence of having their parents nearby to help them sleep.
I'm wondering if it's an adult, they might be able to give a slightly more rational response. But with a kid, you know, with a wild imagination, does it differ in how you would apply that to an adult if you're asking, you know, what are your irrational fears or anxieties at night? Have you come across any challenges with dealing with kids' answers to those types of questions?
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting developmental stage because on the one hand, with some younger kids, the fear could be monsters under their bed. So you've got to sort of, you know, have some discussions and, like you say, ask questions about them, asking these questions about these monsters, how big are they, what colour are they and so forth. And then you say, okay, well, if they're that big, how do they fit underneath your bed?
Right.
So you sort of get more skilled about trying to sort of look at the logic of their sort of thoughts. But at the other end of the spectrum, you can have the sort of older children who are attending school and will say, okay, so what worries you about, you know, not being able to fall asleep at night? And they'll say, oh, it's going to take me a long time to fall asleep. And we say, well, so what's so bad about that? And they say, I won't get enough sleep. And we say, so what's the problem with that? I'll be really sleepy the next day. What's the problem with that? I won't do really well with my grades and then I won't be able to get a good job and I won't be able to support my kids later on. I actually had a child, a nine-year-old, that said that, and it was exactly what I hear from adults. Yeah. So it was incredible how much, you know, we had these sort of young adults coming through voicing very similar thoughts. So it's certainly an interesting age range where you can get these really wide and varied worries and thoughts. And having worked myself with kids and with adults, you know, you can rationally talk about these things during the light of day in a clinic and in an office, but, you know, come nighttime, it can be much more irrational, both for adults and for kids. Yeah. So it's interesting that trying to translate those skills when people go home.
Yeah. Just on that subject, I mean, it's such a common thing, isn't it? This when the anxieties come out pre-bedtime, you know, you've had the best day ever and then it will come to bedtime. And then suddenly these anxieties will just flood out. It's like, where did that come from?
Yeah, exactly. And again, I'm extrapolating from the adult literature here, but and it's certainly something I heard a lot of even with adults with insomnia. They said they had a great day and then they put their head down at night and suddenly there's this flood of thoughts and worries. And kids can also be the same. And when you look at the literature, it's interesting when people are doing almost like you could sort of say daily surveys multiple times during the day, and if you look at when they worry, they seem to worry first thing in the morning and last thing at night. And I guess the theory that we have is that when you are basically going to bed, you're turning the lights off, suddenly you have no visual stimulation to distract you, you have no auditory stimulation to distract you, and potentially those background thoughts that are often present, they're just more loud and they're there, you're more aware of them. And so this is probably what's happening. You know, kids are all distracted with schoolwork, having fun, playing, all the chores they got to do. Put them down to bed at night, suddenly they're so in tune to their thoughts. And again, for adults. So in these cases, we sort of are starting to develop, I guess, techniques that we would call cognitive distraction, sort of techniques you can do in the lead up to bedtime to really minimize paying attention to those thoughts as a sort of a quick way or maybe a simpler way to deal with cognitive contributions to sleep problems as opposed to the hard work and practice of doing cognitive therapy.
I mean, do you recommend for children having sounds and music at night? Can those kind of things help?
Yep, that's something that we'll suggest. Like sometimes, you know, listening to music and having to go through what sort of music that would be. And I'm a little bit biased as a teenager. I actually used to fall asleep listening to Metallica. It was a way to sort of just really drown out all of those thoughts when you're trying to study.
There you go.
So I'm bringing a bit of a bias there, but it can be music in some ways. Reading a book, if it's a fairly good book, that can help distract you. These are quiet activities, but I've also noticed when we've looked at the literature in relationship to TV and sleep, there's actually a correlation that's much more closer to zero, if anything, which has really interested us because we hear of some people that say that when they watch TV at night, you know, they fall asleep in front of the TV and that's a distraction. Yeah. You're not interacting with this TV. You have no influence over it, really. And so we've also suggested that for particular cases as well. So this is something that people can sometimes try for kids. You know, maybe when they're doing this bedtime restriction therapy, they've got to go to bed later. the idea might be to watch a bit more TV and then go to sort of reading a book and then go listen to some music, sort of de-stimulate and help hopefully distract from worrying thoughts if they're going to go to bed later.
I need silence, but I guess it's a very individual kind of thing, as you say, isn't it? I mean, you listen to Metallica, that would probably get all my stress hormones going straight away, but I guess it's a very personal thing, isn't it?
Exactly, yes. I won't recommend that to other people yet.
No, not without the evidence.
Exactly.
Let's move on to talking about parasomnias. This is the last section of the book, and you talk very specifically about the types of parasomnias that are common in school-aged children. First of all, can you explain what a parasomnia is? Because it's a specific subset of sleep disorders, and parasomnias is one of those brackets, and it's one of those sort of exotic branches of sleep disorders, isn't it? But there are certain ones that are very specific to school-aged children. But I just wondered if you could explain broadly what a parasomnia is.
Yeah, so a parasomnia is when a child or person will wake up during sleep, and it's usually in the first half of their sort of sleep at night, and they'll perform some sort of unusual activity. So commonly what you'll see in younger children, and it sometimes can still present in school-aged children, is something called a night terror. So they will wake up and they will be highly distressed. They won't be completely opening their eyes. They'll sometimes be responsive to people around them. When people try to reassure them, they actually can get more agitated. However, in the mornings, they have no memory of it. And so the basis of some of these parasomnias is that the child is actually in quite a deep sleep. And there's been almost this burst of arousal that's woken them up out of sleep, and then you get these unusual behaviours. So not only can you get the night terrors, which can be quite distressing for the family members, but you can also get sleepwalking. And, that can be sometimes quite harmful, especially we've heard situations where the child has tried to unlock the front door and walk out. And in adults, if it does last that long, you get certain behaviours like sleep eating, where they will just go to the fridge and they'll eat something, and the next morning they have no memory of it, but they can see that there's this half-eaten donuts or fish fingers that are lying around the kitchen.
I read about someone eating the contents of an ashtray. That sounded like the very bizarre end of the spectrum.
Yes, and you can also have these cases where people claim that they have sleep sex as well, and bad cases of sometimes sleep driving, although sometimes they're sort of linked with certain medications. These are quite rare, but it's something nevertheless we had to really address in the book, because at least in younger children, toddlers and so forth, these parasomnias can sometimes occur when the child is not getting enough sleep. So if we're recommending to families to try to restrict the sleep of children, then we've got to also be aware that if they have these sort of problems of having a parasomnia, what to also do about that. And likewise, it was really important for us to measure this in our research when we were doing sleep restriction therapy with these families. And to our surprise, we weren't getting a lot of this occurring at all. And this was including children that had a previous history of parasomnias or a current history of parasomnias. It was a real surprise, because everyone says not to do it because you will get these parasomnias. But I think what we've learned is this is something that's certainly the case for younger children and toddlers, but it might not be the case for school-age kids. So it was a nice sort of scientific finding for us. But anyway, in the book we do outline a couple of techniques that parents can use if they have a child that has this sort of problem.
Before you talk about those specific techniques, can you just break down? I think there's a lot of misunderstanding between night terrors and people just think nightmares, but it's a very specific, this was a very specific thing, isn't it, night terrors?
Yeah, so night terrors do occur out of deep sleep, and because they occur out of deep sleep, children are unlikely to remember them in the morning, and it's also more likely to occur in the first few hours of sleep, whereas nightmares, they usually occur out of the dreaming sleep, and children are more likely to be able to recall that they had this nightmare or dream. They won't do it 100%, when it comes to the recall, but they're more likely to do it. And that's usually going to occur, the nightmares, in the second half of the night. So this is going to be in the early hours of the morning, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 a.m. But they can have a presentation that looks like that. So when some child has a night terror, it can actually look like they're having some sort of nightmare. They're quite distressed by it. But we do specify in the book that essentially if the child cannot remember it and it's also towards the beginning of the night, it's far more likely to be a night terror as opposed to a nightmare.
It can be really, really distressing for the parents as well, because they can literally be, you know, inconsolable, but at the same time, seemingly terrified out of their wits.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you can go onto YouTube and type in night terror and people can see it for themselves and manipulate the volume to their will, because it is very hard to hear.
Okay, very briefly, so bedwetting, that's classed in this bracket of parasomnias as well, that we wouldn't necessarily bracket that as a sleep disorder, but that's something you talk about as well.
Yeah, and it can be something, again, we have to sort of address with families, because if they are doing something like sleep restriction, and when you do something like this, it's going to really build up the intensity of their deep sleep, and if it is doing that, then we want to basically arm parents with some sort of techniques that might be able to help them if they find that their child starts to do some of this bedwetting. And for cases where it's like pure bedwetting, you will have the literature suggesting that bed alarms probably do help, you know, something like 7 out of 10 children. But, you know, some children find that quite alarming, for lack of a better word, so they don't like to have them. So there are other techniques that parents can use, and we also, once again, suggest a couple that they can try.
You do recommend, again, some evidence-based treatments and techniques. Can you run through those?
Yeah, so there are a couple of suggestions. So one is, because you are really intensifying the deep sleep that the child is having, if you are doing something like sleep restriction therapy, then the immediate thing is to try to give them some more sleep. So there can be different ways of doing that, and it can be something as simple as just sort of getting them to go to bed 15 minutes earlier so they can get a little bit of sleep, seeing how that goes, and trying to sort of do a bit of what we would call cause and effect, change one thing, see what the result is. Sometimes it can be letting the child sleep in 15 minutes later. Sometimes it can be just only allowing them to sort of have a bit more of a sleep in on the weekend, whether they can have a nap, even like one nap a week. In some ways, they're trying to catch up on a bit of sleep and seeing how if that has an effect of de-intensifying their deep sleep overall, and therefore less likely to have these parasomnias. And another technique that we still don't know the mechanism that governs it is that it's called scheduled awakening. So the idea is you do a sleep diary for a week and you try to locate when the child is on average falling asleep and then at what time the child during the night is having these parasomnias. And then the following week, you're trying to anticipate the occurrence of these parasomnias. So say they seem to be occurring on average at 10:30 at night, then the idea is sort of 15 to 30 minutes before that would occur, you actually try to wake your child up, but not completely, just enough so that they look like they're not sleeping. And somehow that seems to break that progression of having a parasomnia that night. But again, we just don't know the reason, don't know how it came about. But this is a technique that seems to also provide some relief, even as quickly sometimes as a week for some families.
Appreciate you saying, you know, we're not sure how that mechanism works, but essentially you're disrupting the sleep cycle, and potentially there's something going on with the natural occurrence of these parasomnias. So it's been really, really interesting. We've raced through the book. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I think the last chapter in the book that we wanted to touch upon, and actually the book editors wanted us to write a lot more about, was eventually these school-age kids turn into adolescents at some point and things start to change in their bodies that do disrupt sleep. So we wanted to forewarn parents so that, you know, if they got to the point where they were trying a lot of these techniques and they had a child that had, you know, much better sleep health. Our research has also tried to track the kids that we've done this with over years, and we find that once they cross that sort of wall of puberty, the good sleep practices can still be there and they can still have healthy sleep, but not for all of them. And sometimes they develop completely new sleep problems that the techniques in our book don't teach the parents about, because essentially teenagers start to have this natural drift in their body clock where, or their chronotype, where they start to naturally fall asleep later and wake up later. And that requires a different set of techniques for parents and teenagers to try to circumvent that problem. But we do provide some suggestions in the book, some simple suggestions. For instance, our researchers found time and time again that if you can set a bedtime for your child throughout their teenage, well, as much as possible throughout their early teenage years at least, on school nights, then that's a huge protective factor for their sleep and how they function the next day. So it's a very simple thing to do. And very hard to do, though, once you stop doing that. So we really urge parents to try to maintain that practice for as long as they can in their child's teen years.
Yes. So potentially, you know, you followed your book and you've conquered it, and then the teenage years come and then it all starts again.
Yes, exactly.
Can you tell us where people can get hold of the book?
Yep. So the book is called Helping Your Child with Sleep Problems. So they can purchase the book by going onto Little Brown Book Group. They sell it in the UK. It should be in bookstores there as well, Hatchet and Amazon as well. I hope that we can really help a lot of parents out there in the world rather than us only helping sort of parents that come to us at Flinders University here.
Thanks so much, Michael. Really, really appreciate it. And fantastic. Big thumbs up for the book.
Excellent. And thank you so much for this opportunity to talk with you, Jeff. It's been fantastic to see someone who's really just wanted to delve in and do their own research and is really passionate about this area. So I really appreciate you sort of getting these messages out there to everyone in the community. So thanks. Thumbs up to you too.
You've been listening to the Sleep Junkies podcast. If you like this episode, don't forget to subscribe, leave us a review on iTunes, and check us out on social media, on Facebook, on Instagram, or on the website sleepjunkies.com. Hope to see you on the next episode. Sleep well.